So if you look back at even just the last like 3 years of who's won Best Picture at the Oscars, so The Daniels last year with Everything Everywhere All at Once, Chloe Zhao with Nomadland the year before that, Sean Hader with Coda the year before that, and even having this year nominated for Best Picture, we mentioned it earlier, Chris Nolan with Oppenheimer, Greta Gerwig with Barbie. I mean, we can't forget Past Lives, which is a film that played and debuted at Sundance last year. These are films and filmmakers that were nurtured and supported early in their career by Sundance Institute.
This is the Box Office Podcast. I'm Daniel Luria, the editorial director of Box Office Pro, the pulse of theatrical exhibition. Once again, joined by my colleague and co-host, Rebecca Pauly, deputy editor here at Box Office Pro. And in this week's episode, we will be going over a quick recap of the Academy Awards that happened last weekend. Out there in Los Angeles. And in our feature segment, we've got an interview with Eugene Hernandez, the director of the Sundance Film Festival and public programming over at the Sundance Institute. Eugene and I talk everything on the world of art house and some of the new initiatives that the Sundance Institute is putting out, including a new partnership with a major exhibitor. But let's start the way we always do. Rebecca, another weekend in the books. What did you see?
In terms of new to me stuff, I kept with my trend of just watching junk on Tubi. Yeah, you know, Daniel, I like to watch my junk on Tubi. Helps me unwind from a busy week. But no, then on Sunday that was the Oscars. Always a big thing. Eric and I like to go out and hang with friends and watch it. And he gets real intense about the Oscar ballot. I just kind of don't take that particularly seriously, but I do think it was a fun ceremony.
That's good. That's good to hear. I think we spoke about this when we went over the nominees. I'm usually very cynical, might even be putting it nicely. I don't really see the use of the Academy Awards from a professional perspective or a personal perspective.
It's made up.
But yeah, totally. I think it does more harm than good. But we do have to basically come in and correct yourself sometimes. And I think this year is an exception to however I might feel about these award shows. This is actually one of those years where if you think about what the concept of the Academy Awards can do for the industry as a whole in promoting films with a wider theatrical release bump that the nominations can push them in and help these films get seen, this year did that. Get high-profile titles that people did see in theaters, that people want to talk about and sort of track the award progression. That also happened.
I believe it was Cord Jefferson in his accepted speech who went on an impassioned plea for, hey, we need more like $10 million movies. Like, don't just make $200 million movies and movies that cost. Like, there needs to be that middle ground. And it sounded like a very popular sentiment in the room, something we've definitely talked about a lot.
And that's part of that diversity, right? It's not only diversity in terms of having people that come from different cultures, both in front of and behind the camera.
Mm-hmm. It's giving people opportunities across, you know, because you don't have to make this idea that you only have to make a movie on, you know, $20 and shoestring and $200 million, you know, something that needs to make $200 million in order to be deemed successful. Yeah. And we saw throughout this last year, we saw some of those films succeed, and we saw some of those films succeed last night at the Oscars. I'm thinking in particular, we have, Godzilla won its first Oscar, he won for visual effects. That film, we saw The Boy and the Heron win for Best Animated Feature, beating...
And these are two Japanese films, we have to add, and that's fantastic to see these foreign films
Godzilla
coming
minus,
in and getting these nominations and Godzilla, getting these awards.
Yeah, Godzilla Minus One, I mean, really got that push on theatrical. Like, people wanted to see this in theatrical. Yeah. It got a theatrical re-release in black and white. I saw a LinkedIn post from our friend Chance Husky at G-Kids, who handles distribution there. And he noted that The Boy and the Heron was only theatrical in the United States. It's a theatrical movie, full stop. It didn't do any of that. The event itself, it definitely felt like a Barbenheimer victory lap, very well deserved. Barbie not, you know, winning much by way of awards, but like at this point, I feel like Barbie's already won everything.
I mean, it's already, like,
It's won in the larger sense, and the Ryan Gosling Ken musical number.
Like nobody expected to come to the Academy Awards and Barbie to have any Academy Award nominations. The fact that it's in the Best Picture race is wonderful. Let's go over to recap this Best Picture race that we had this year, Rebecca, because we're talking about diversity in the marketplace in terms of budget levels, in terms of genres, and having that diversity represented here in the nominations. You had Oppenheimer, a movie that made almost $1 billion worldwide, a big studio drama. That ends up taking Best Picture. It's good for the industry when a movie like that, that is widely seen, that is a little bit different, but still a major studio picture, wins Best Picture. I didn't love the movie. It's irrelevant. It's important for movies that get seen to win that award.
I think Chris Nolan he's getting, you know, and he won the Best Director as well. You know, he makes those big movies that are crowd-friendly and audience-friendly, right, and still on balance, I think, critically well-reviewed. Four wins for Searchlight Pictures for Poor Things, which actually I love that movie. I know we both do, and we love Emma Stone's performance in it. It was definitely, I think, a flip of the coin between Emma Stone and Lee Gladstone as to who would win Best Actress. And again, we see with Poor Things, I mean, this is a movie that debuted, I believe, at the Venice Film Festival, did a slow rollout to a whole bunch of international film festivals, local film festivals, and then that theatrical kind of slow platform release, leading to, like, eventually it came out on Hulu. It's on Hulu now, I guess, but
a movie like this that's made over $100 million worldwide, the fact that Poor Things was even released by Searchlight is a victory when you consider the very graphic elements that the film has. And it has, I think, also a very incisive narrative in there that I think works very well. But it is by no means an audience-friendly film.
No.
Poor Things is the sort of movie that will alienate an audience. And the fact that it's able to not only get an Academy Award nomination, get that Best Actress win for star Emma Stone, it gets a lot more people seeing this movie.
I want the insights from people watching it on Hulu today, never having...
Yeah, I think that might be interesting. But it's also a difficult movie to watch on Hulu or on any streaming platform. If you think about it, it's almost 3 hours long. It really requires a lot of concentration. It's a total movie theater performer. And you look at other movie theater performers, I think of a movie like Anatomy of a Fall, a French language courtroom drama. Again, we talk about diversity, different movies from different places, a foreign language drama coming in, set almost, entirely in a cabin and a courtroom, but it's riveting. It's a fantastic film that I can't see having that same impact going straight to streaming. We talk about foreign films. We talk about difficult films for audiences. The Zone of Interest from Jonathan Glazer, for me, the best picture of last year, a wonderful, wonderful film, difficult to watch, also alienating, also challenging for an audience. You have that in, and you compare that with other very accessible titles in the best picture race, like Barbie, like something like American Fiction, which has a satirical element, but also has a little bit of an edge and heart to it. A movie like The Holdovers, which has a diverse cast, bringing in, I think, not a period piece, but a 1970s narrative that's actually quite interesting from a different perspective. A Maestro, which is the less said, the better. And also an independent film like Past Lives from another first-time writer-director, Celine Song. And when we mentioned first-time writer-directors, Cord Jefferson from American Fiction is also in that picture. It's great to see that. Of course, you finish up the batch with Killers of the Flower Moon, an Apple release, which is another big studio drama
Which didn't win anything. And that's, I gather from... I try not to get into whatever drama film Twitter is trying to spin itself into, but apparently that was a big bone of contention that it doesn't win anything. It's an amazing Scorsese film.
No one's going to remember that it didn't win anything. Yeah. Nobody ever remembers any of these things. These are important nominations and important awards to help push these movies that aren't widely seen, like A Poor Things, like Anatomy of a Fall, like The Zone of Interest, into a much wider theatrical release than they ever would have. You have your movies that are accessible, that were widely released, that are beloved, and it's a movie like Zone of Interest that is so difficult to sit through, that is not audience friendly, that is not accessible, that is ambitious in a way that few films are ambitious. And it's a sort of film that I think we're going to be remembering 30, 40, 50 years from now. And it wouldn't have gotten the release theatrically that it got had it not been for these awards. So I can be cynical and difficult all I want. Rebecca, the fact is, when you have something like this, like the Academy Awards, help promote difficult to watch films and help celebrate films that everybody got to see and enjoy, it was perfect, right?
It was an interesting ceremony as these things go. I think it was a good night for cinema, and it was a good night to remind us of the importance of the theatrical in that landscape to promote, you know, awards wins and streaming traffic later on. I think it's a rising tide lifts all boats situation. And yeah. Next year, I mean, we're going to be seeing, hopefully, imagine some of the films that premiered in Sundance earlier this year. It certainly has a track record of taking films through award season.
That was a really good transition, Rebecca, because that's exactly what our feature interview in today's episode is going to be about. I interview Eugene Hernandez, the director of the Sundance Film Festival, and also, full transparency here, my first boss in the industry. I worked for Eugene over at IndieWire, and then I followed him over to the Film Society at Lincoln Center. He was the director at the New York Film Festival as well before becoming the director of the Sundance Film Festival. And Sundance, Rebecca, is now starting a new initiative in Mexico City, partnering with Cinepolis to bring the first edition of Sundance Film Festival, CDMX, that is short for Mexico City, that is happening in two Cinepolis locations in Mexico City from April 25th to 28th. A great initiative bringing in this independent slate of programming internationally. Mexico is a great, great box office market. One of the things that I'm always pushing for in that market is, can we please get something else than family films on Mexican screens? Eugene and I speak about everything on the Sundance front and some of that DNA that the Sundance Film Festival has always contributed to the Academy Awards. We talk about Barbenheimer, two huge, huge titles, $1 billion plus earner on the Barbie side, nearly $1 billion earner worldwide for Oppenheimer. Chris Nolan, Greta Gerwig, two Sundance alums. Two people that are very recognizable on the independent film scene, got their start in the independent film scene, and a lot of titles that have also gone through the Sundance Institute and the Sundance Film Festival, continuously being part of that Oscar pedigree. So we thought this would be a great opportunity to have a nice lengthy conversation, not only on the festival itself, but also on the state of art house theaters that is coming up after the break. So Eugene, I'm really excited and happy to get you on the podcast, talk everything about Sundance. I know a festival that is near and dear to you, and talk everything about movie going, movie culture, media, because you've also been very involved in the evolving role that media plays in film culture. Welcome. And how was Park City this year?
Park City was terrific. I mean, the thing that I got there a few days into the new year, kind of like first week of January, and we got a lot of snow just in time for the festival. I had heard going in that it was a pretty light snow for the holidays and for the holiday seasons. People were really kind of anxious for it. And then I got there like 10 days before the festival or so, and we got a lot of snow. So by the time everybody arrived at the festival, it had this new fresh coating of snow. It looked exactly like you want Sundance to look. And I think that just laid the foundation for what felt like a real kind of classic Sundance Film Festival experience, you know. And so it was great.
Well, it is your first time working in an official capacity at Sundance, but it wasn't by any means your first time at the Sundance Film Festival. And this is what I love about you and something you imparted me when we first started working together now over 10 years ago at IndieWire is your personal connection to this industry as a community and the role that Sundance played in being this primer and in welcoming you into the community and being a forum to make connections and turning this very vague classification of independent film and art house cinema into just people and relationships. Can you tell me about that first Sundance? What was that experience like for you? And what has that festival meant for you and your career for the last 25 years plus?
Yeah, I mean, look, you're right, Daniel. Like, this was my first year sitting in this seat, running the festival. but it was my 30th time attending the festival. So it was special in what was Sundance's 40th edition to be having my own 30th edition celebration. But it is interesting because I think when that first year that I attended, and it was actually 1993, I missed one along the way, but it was 1993. And you're exactly right. I think that something formative happened for me. And I can say this now, decades later, looking back at that time period. And I do think about the independent film business. Some can call it an industry. I do call it a community. I do think of that independent film community as something that is very much relationship driven and individually connected to the connections and the relationships we build with each other. And I say that because in my first year in 93, riding on a shuttle bus at the festival, running around the festival, my first time, I met one of my business partners who I co-founded IndieWire with, Mark Rabinowitz. He and Sherry Barner, who I had gone to UCLA with, who I went to school with, and I started IndieWire together in the mid-90s. We brought in our good friend, who you know well, Brian Brooks, as well, and a few others. And it was those relationships and those connections between people that I think really laid the foundation, not only for IndieWire, but honestly, people I met at that very first Sundance, friends that I made at that very first Sundance, are folks that are still really important to me, and connections that are really important to me, relationships that are really important to me.
And that's very similar, I have to be honest with you, with the experience that I think I've had going from when I started my career, understanding that a publication has to be part of its community. Not only do you source better stories as a journalist, but you become embedded and vital to that community. And I got to see that firsthand with the way that you ran IndieWire back when we were there together. I've been able to see that firsthand here at Box Office in the exhibition community, which kind of like the independent film community, there's a national component, there's an international component. It's not a company town sort of business. It's people that are in here. No one's getting super rich out of this, let's be honest. But we're here because we have a passion for it. And it's people that once they're in there, your relationships evolve as time goes on, but the business also changes. And I wanted to move on to that aspect of the Sundance Film Festival, because from 1993 to 2024, there's been a huge evolution on the role that American independent cinema and its capital, being the Sundance Film Festival, plays for the entertainment industry at large. And you've been able to see that and to cover that professionally in your career, that evolution of what Sundance means to the industry. So I wanted to pose that question to you. Having that front row seat to this evolution, what do you think Sundance means to today's film industry?
That's a really great question. And it's something, this question of what Sundance means to the industry, this question of the role Sundance plays in the community that we're talking about, the question of Sundance's connection to the film community and to the film business is something we thought a lot about, and I thought a lot about in this first year of being at the Institute. So I came into the festival November of 2022, going into the 2023 festival, but we were like a week, 10 days away from finalizing the selection, the lineup for that festival. So I was able to get a really kind of firsthand look at not only the process of shaping and honing and finalizing that lineup, but then the conversations you have with that industry, with those filmmakers, with that community, from the moment the selection is made in November, usually a little before Thanksgiving, right up to the festival that happens in mid-January. And then pivoting from the 23 festival and jumping right in a year ago, almost to the moment when the last year's festival ended, and starting to wrap the festival and look ahead to the future. And I say all that because I was really thinking a lot about that relationship that Sundance has within that independent community, because I think that knowing that we were going into the 40th edition this year, it was really important for me to be grounded in that history, to really understand it and to tap into my own connection to that history, having attended almost 30 years, but really starting to watch movies from Sundance. I was in college, I was at UCLA, in the mid 80s when Sundance started having that influence and started affecting or influencing the conversation, the cultural conversation around independent film, with films like Sex, Lies, and Videotape in 89. And, you know, from a box office perspective or from an industry perspective, there's a whole conversation we can have about sort of the role that that film played in particular. And we had Steven Soderbergh back at the festival this year with his new film Presence. What I see up front and what I've seen for three decades now is, I really believe strongly, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to work at Sundance when the opportunity came, I really have seen that the role that Sundance plays in being a mechanism for discovery, for showcasing what's new, for being a place for celebrating the diversity, and I mean that in every possible different way that you can apply it to independent and international film right now, but that diversity, that inclusion of stories from all different backgrounds, points of views, and perspectives. Sundance plays, I think, a really crucial role in setting that standard and pushing forward that mission. And ultimately, the last thing I'll add on that, just to make a finer point on it, is really upholding the vision that Mr. Redford, Robert Redford, established in creating both the Institute first in the mid-80s and then developing the relationship with what was first originally called the U.S. Film Festival, a festival that was created in Salt Lake City by the Utah Film Commission. And when it became the Sundance Film Festival in the mid-80s, continuing that mission of discovery and also exploration outside of the more traditional Hollywood structure. And that's something I think that I really continue to think about. Hollywood and the mainstream industry is still part of it, but Sundance's place, where Sundance sits, is a little bit off of the center of that.
Now, if we look at the trades, traditionally, you'll see the business reporting around Sundance to be gauged on a metric of sales. Well, there were X number of sales. It was a good Sundance. Sales were slow. It was a bad Sundance. For our purposes here at Box Office, we're not really too interested on how much a film sells for, but we are very interested to know how many pickups are going to make it to our theaters. Not only the big multiplexes, but the art houses across the nation, which, as you know, because you've been involved in this industry as an art house exhibitor as well, it's a very, very important time to make sure that art houses in this country have the support of films coming in with marketing support behind them for audiences to discover for themselves. We're in a critical time in terms of film availability for these cinemas, and Sundance as a discovery ground for those films is super important under that metric of films that can potentially get that theatrical release for our friends in the arthouse film community. How would you gauge this edition of the Sundance Film Festival?
Of course, we're tracking very closely before, during, and after the festival, the market interest and awareness of our films and our filmmakers. I'm mindful of the fact that box office or acquisitions deals and the size of them, box office performance, and whether that's national or international, I'm mindful of the fact that that is one certainly valuable metric that, or a couple of valuable metrics that the industry will use to gauge the health and well-being of the independent marketplace. Certainly from the perspective of the art house theaters, the specialized theaters, and certainly as a representation of sort of what is happening outside of the mainstream, more tentpole kind of mainstream Hollywood releases. So I do have to say a couple things that we had 17,000 submissions, 17,500 submissions this year for the Sundance program. We ended up showing, so that's 17,000 across features, shorts, episodic work. We showed around 90 or so feature films and about 53, 54 short films. So you can see already how difficult it is, right, to go from such a large pool of of submissions to consider for what's a relatively small program. And then within that program, only 10 of those films are in the American narrative competition, 10 are in the documentary competition for the US, and then 10 each in the international competition. So you have 17,000 films competing for, you know, 10 slots in each of those competition sections. About 4,000 of those are features. And now we're at a point where a couple of weeks out of the festival, we're looking at what the activity around the buying and selling of films from the festival, the artists that are getting signed by agencies, which films are getting purchased by theatrical first distributors versus which are going to streamers that might be putting a lower emphasis on theatrical, perhaps. So we're watching all of that. I think it's interesting for us to certainly talk about those metrics. And I know that I'm sitting in front of someone who lives and breathes that, and talking with you at Box Office, that's your lens through which you look at the festival. But from our vantage point at Sundance, also, we also try to look at other metrics. We try to look at, we try not to get too focused on only the theatrical sales or sales generally or box office performance, although that will always be a metric that we continue to think about, because ultimately our role is that of a bridge. Our goal is to be a bridge between the artists themselves and the audience. And there's a lot of different ways that those bridges can be built to allow an audience to discover a film.
As I understand it, I think that the festival circuit is an important platform to champion diverse voices and voices that might not have an opportunity in the studio system. Knowing you and knowing other folks in the festival circuit, I think it's a right call that none of you think market first. I think if you all thought market first, we wouldn't have a relevant and thriving independent film scene. I think we'd have a very one-note vanilla film scene. Fortunately, we don't. And we can see that in the programming, not only in your festival, but many other major and mid-tier festivals, and even local community film festivals all over the country. I think if you try to have a film festival that tries to recreate a multiplex experience, you're going to have a festival that lacks relevance and lacks weight. So yes, I think it's important for you guys to champion voices. However, I think the other side of the equation, and this is coming from our friends on the distribution side, whether it's from the major studios, the specialties, or the independent side, we need those voices that are championed to be heard. It's one thing if you and I sit down after a festival and talk about the great movies we saw, the great discoveries, but the real conversations that have a weight is when we can both sit down at Thanksgiving, at the Thanksgiving table, mention a movie, and be able to say the sentence, "This is how you can watch it. This is where you can find it." And I think that's a key aspect. And to be very honest, I think it's something that is a little bit tougher to get to. I don't think it's something that it's in the responsibility of Sundance or any film festival. And I think exhibitors, as you well know, having been an exhibitor, are very open to be able to get some of these titles. But I do think there's a disconnect there. And I'm not sure what the most effective way to create a streamlined process between a festival discovery, an acquisition, whether that's on streaming or theatrical, and having those voices heard by an audience.
Yeah, that I appreciate everything you're saying. You're exactly right. And maybe what we're talking about, and I'm really thinking about what you just said, Daniel, because I think that path maybe felt more navigable or definable perhaps 15 to 20 to 25 years ago, when it felt like a film could definably come from, and I'm not just talking about Sundance, but could come from Sundance, or there used to be an LA film festival that was really great here in Los Angeles, where I am now. There certainly is, you know, South by Southwest in Austin, and more recently, the Tribeca Festival, now 20 plus years old in New York, and any number of regional festivals, but also like the San Francisco Film Festival in the Bay Area has always been an important pipeline. And others, it felt like we have a moment. We had a moment to look at, in which, especially when home video was such a prevalent sort of part of the infrastructure where a film could have a theatrical release that would be built out of acquisition at festivals and then playing at festivals, building word of mouth, playing in a specialized release, or maybe even a accelerated specialized to national release, and then hitting the home video window, whether on videotape or ultimately on DVD, and then hitting like the TV, the various TV windows, pay-per-view, cable television, and all of that, where the path felt more replicable than perhaps it's felt certainly the last like 5 years. And if we certainly look at even the past 5 years since the pandemic, that major disruption. And what is the disruption really ultimately, other than like audience engaging differently with, like, I think we would say probably no less interest in the kinds of films we're talking about, but a disruption, a complete holistic disruption in how audiences connect with that work. And the only other thing I'll add on that really briefly is that at Sundance, we do take the sort of big picture, long view of this, even though, again, we're looking at, you know, we're watching films that have been acquired out of the festival and what kind of opportunities they're finding, and excited by a film like Jesse Eisenberg's A Real Pain, you know, going to Searchlight, and that film will have a robust theatrical, I'm assuming a theatrical along with where it will go after that. Or, you know, as we're recording this, just today, the announcement of Sony Classics buying Between the Temples for worldwide distribution, another film from the competition at Sundance that will certainly start in a theatrical setting. So it's exciting. Or a film like, you know, Presence getting acquired by the Soderbergh film, getting acquired by Neon. Some of these films that really hopefully will have what we're talking about, which is a more traditional route. That said, other films will go, you know, a film like, Will and Harper being at a film like Will and Harper, a documentary, or a film like Daughters, or some of the other documentaries from the festival that might have a larger life. Like, they might have a theatrical component to their lives, right? But may also have a larger life and a larger reach through streaming. So these are all really interesting ways that I think when we talk about, and I can be nostalgic about it, when we talk about, like, you know, the 80s and 90s world of like films finding their way very slowly to an audience. And I know that when we're talking about streaming, that might be antithetical to some of the folks who are listening to this podcast, or has a certainly disruptive impact on the business of those who are listening to this podcast and that you guys write about. But it's a factor. It's sort of how we think about sort of the reach of some of the films that we play at the festival.
Well, I think we also have to think about Sundance in conjunction with the Sundance Institute. The other role that Sundance plays is as a talent incubator. So even if a specific film might or might not be a fit for a specific theater or a streaming service, it is a launching ground for many careers and an opportunity for filmmakers maybe to get a first film. And more importantly, and you know this working in the independent film community, especially filmmakers of color, especially minority filmmakers, you might get one, but making that second or third film, that's the breakoff point. And how many examples have we seen between the 80s and 90s and today that's really where we need filmmakers to get that support? And I see that's the role being that the Sundance Film Festival can contribute to.
And that's the other part of it that at Sundance Film Festival, for those who are listening and may not sort of understand the bigger ecosystem or picture that you're talking about, Sundance Film Festival is a program of this larger not-for-profit organization called Sundance Institute. And that's the organization I was referring to earlier when I was talking about the work that Mr. Redford did in the early 80s to launch this institute that was meant to be a place to champion the kinds of alternative, diverse, inclusive voices that you're talking about. But when we take a half step back or a full step back and look at the impact of the work that the Institute has done and how it has intersected with mainstream entertainment, even, or let's use the metric of the Academy Awards, for example, just as an example. And I wasn't at Sundance when a number of the films and filmmakers that I'm going to refer to made their way through the Institute. But it's a point of respect and acknowledgement that I want to make to my colleagues at Sundance Institute, in particular, my colleague Michelle Satter, who runs the artistic programs and labs and fellowships of the Institute. So if you look back at even just the last like 3 years of who's won Best Picture at the Oscars, so the Daniels last year with Everything Everywhere All at Once, Chloe Zhao with Nomadland the year before that, Sean Hader with Coda the year before that, and even, you know, having this year nominated for Best Picture, we mentioned it earlier, Chris Nolan with Oppenheimer, Greta Gerwig with Barbie. I mean, we can't forget, you know, Past Lives, which is a film that played and debuted at Sundance last year. These are films and filmmakers that were nurtured and supported early in their career by Sundance Institute. So if you look at that impact that's happening and that kind of bigger picture kind of metric of having that influence on mass entertainment culture, it is interesting to your point and to where you were going with your comments, like to look at how for the last number of years, and we'll see who wins Best Picture this year, but for the last number of years, films and filmmakers that have a connection to Sundance Institute and festival broadly have been the ones either in the final mix or winning, you know, the industry's greatest, most coveted award or honor. And so that just, what that tells us is that I think the industry has also, even in the world of like Marvel movies, and of course there's a number of filmmakers from Sundance who've gone on to direct Marvel movies, but even in a world of very big mainstream tentpole releases that are worldwide, that are global releases, right, on the same day, the influence of Sundance and its artists and its work is profound when you can see it having those tentacles and those touch points that are much bigger than just the work that we're talking about at one festival over one particular year. It's like, it's an ongoing conversation.
You've also worked in the media space, being one of the founders of IndieWire, and you were also involved with publication of Film Comment while you were at Film and Lincoln Center. So you also know the role that media plays, and you also know the difficulties that media is currently facing in being able to survive and play that role in a film's life cycle. How do you think the current setup that we have is working? Do you think it's as efficient as it used to be when you first started IndieWire? Or is it a little bit more difficult? Or is it a completely different strategy to begin with to reach those audiences so a film that premieres at your festival can still be relevant and have some awareness by the time it reaches theaters?
It's a tough moment. You know, the editorial side of, first of all, let me take a half step back and say that a healthy editorial marketplace for film criticism, for quality journalism and commentary, for substantive conversation, interviews with films and filmmakers and talent, from my point of view, is a fundamental part, fundamental spoke, an essential. I'll say it even more emphatically than that, an essential part of a vibrant and healthy film community. I think we are in a moment where there remain some really strong critical voices, and we saw some really strong critical perspectives and voices at the festival this year. That's really important. At the same time, I think it's harder for independent journalists who are freelance, who might not be affiliated with one publication, or even for some of those publications themselves, that, you know, it was during this year's festival that the LA Times laid off a number of people, including folks who were attending the Sundance Film Festival. You know, I was at a dinner at a restaurant that same night when folks from the LA Times were having what is typically an annual dinner where they sort of raise a glass to the end of the festival, and instead they were sadly talking about folks who, their colleagues, some of whom were at the festival, were just laid off. So this is a tumultuous moment for editorial. Now, what still gives me hope, although it at the same time is concerning, is the continued work of independent and independent-minded journalists, critics, writers, to create alternate ways to get their voice out into that world, whether that's through newsletters or even through substantive and smart social media work, podcasts. And I think there's been a lot of really great work that we've seen evolve into a podcast format over the last number of years. And the other area that I'm watching, and we were watching closely at Sundance this year, was TikTok, and having, you know, a dozen sort of notable folks who cover the film space at the festival, and a partnership that Sundance did with TikTok as a way to just, again, explore, because I think we're at a moment that's kind of not unlike the moment when I started going to Sundance 30 years ago and we created IndieWire. It was created out of a necessity of the business and the culture and the creativity that was happening among independent storytellers and storytelling needed a voice and a platform to connect and support that work. And so that's why I really feel like, and that's why I said a second ago that I really feel it's such a fundamental part, such an essential part of a healthy film culture, is having that independent editorial voice that can amplify, critique, challenge, uplift, and somehow engage the work itself. You can't really have it a healthy community without both of those kind of working in tandem. So it's something that remains of great concern to me as someone who comes from the editorial perspective, who comes from being an editor of publication, who used to go to Sundance and write multiple articles per day and try to like capture those stories. I think it's harder right now. And I hope that the ingenuity that I continue to see from independent journalists can continue, but we're in a very different media landscape right now.
Well, I do have to commend you guys over at Sundance for being one of the innovators in making covering the festival accessible. And it's one of the pivots that happened because of the pandemic. And I don't like to spend too much time talking about the pandemic now, because we launched this podcast in 2020 and it's been four straight years, it feels like, of talking about exhibition post-pandemic. But you were at the Film and Lincoln Center during the pandemic, running basically an art house and repertory theater. You were also involved in the New York Film Festival during the pandemic. You're one of the first festivals to make that pivot to streaming and having a drive-in component to the New York Film Festival. And One of the things that I think has survived is part of those pivots of the pandemic that I really like that Sundance is doing, that you continue to evolve the concept of attending Sundance from home. So I want to talk a little bit about that innovation, having that experience of bringing the screening components in, working with local drive-ins all over New York City for that New York Film Festival that you guys had during the pandemic. What worked in that post-pandemic pivot? And what is still relevant for you guys in the festival community? And what maybe didn't work out so well?
I think what both worked and didn't work, they're kind of two sides of the same coin. And that is the audience maintaining a passionate interest, thankfully, in alternative cinema, independent cinema, movies coming from diverse voices, discovery films, films by first-time directors that people have never heard of. The fact that Coda was the film that one of the films that really popped that year at Sundance, in the same way that, you know, other films in the past had gone on to great attention, like one of those screenings where you, and I watched that one at home like most people, because there was no in-person Sundance that year, or Summer of Soul even, which was the same year, and I watched that film at home and had as transformative an experience watching that film at home with a few people, because we couldn't watch it together in person, and then having a rich digital experience, again, not replacing the in-person one, but Sundance built what was called the Spaceship, which was a virtual gathering place, so that after screenings, we could log on and have a human connection through technology of sharing a shared experience. So I think what Sundance has done, and some of this happened before I arrived, and we've continued this approach under my leadership there, and we continue to take feedback from the industry and from our artists in particular, first and foremost, as it continues to evolve, is trying to figure out how to preserve and return to what is first and foremost an in-person experience. And so you saw that this year in staging the festival the way we did, having the in-person premiere experience in Park City being the primary focus for the first week, and then in the second week pivoting to a digital component. That's the reason we've held on to it, and we'll every year continue to evaluate if it makes sense to do it, and if there's a right way to do it, we'll give it a shot. But that's the calculation. So thank you for letting me sort of explain it longer, but that's really the calculus, is like how do we support the mission of the organization and provide access for both an audience and an artist, but also preserve that in-person theatrical experience. And that's what we changed this year in moving the digital piece to the end of the festival to really allow that first week to happen and grow in person.
It's all about finding that balance, right? I think there's a lot of opportunities in streaming, but like you say, we as arts organizations have to defend the in-person experience. We have to protect the in-person experience. That doesn't mean you throw away streaming or you make it an adversarial situation, but if you can find a way to complement that experience, I think it's a great match. Thank you so much for all your time, Eugene. I do want to close by asking your perspectives on the art house film scene. Right now, you've been involved very closely in the past on the board, the transition board of the Art House Convergence, which is, we can call it a trade group, mostly of nonprofit and mission-driven cinemas. You've seen that group get past the pandemic and evolve to where they are now, which has a newly instituted board. And we have a newly revitalized version of the Art House Convergence event coming to Chicago this June. Can you tell us a little bit of your insight on how that recovery for art house and nonprofit cinemas has come through after that low point of 2020?
Oh, I mean, I'm glad you asked about it, because I think I have so much profound respect and admiration for my friends and colleagues who work in the mission-driven art house film scene. These are neighborhood theaters that are often owned by families or community-driven spaces, sometimes at museums or small art house theater chains in different parts of the country, that are so resilient and so innovative and so persistent to championing and supporting exactly what you were talking about a second ago, Daniel, which is that preservation of the theatrical experience as one that is fundamental to a way of experiencing movies. In the same way earlier that I said that I felt like, you know, independent editorial platforms and publications were essential to a healthy culture and a healthy film culture, I think that art house theaters, and particular mission-driven and often nonprofit art house theaters and local festivals, are essential to a healthy community, a healthy just fundamental community. Having you know, bookstores and independent restaurants and independent movie theaters as places for gathering and watching and connecting, not just with movies, but with people, are, I think, essential parts of a community. So the work I've done in that space, and especially when I was working, as you mentioned, at Lincoln Center, where at that time we had, you know, three movie theaters that were shut down, like many, like all movie theaters, and faced the same kind of struggles that many others faced in all parts of the world and parts of our country, in trying to figure out how to survive through that closure and then how to bounce back. What is really inspirational for me is that a group of leaders from the art house community stepped up at the time that I was in that transitional working group. A group of leaders stepped up to continue that work and to develop a brand new conference that will happen this summer in Chicago, as you mentioned, continuing to share information, to share resources, to share stories about how to sustain or the work that they're doing in local communities. Like these are vibrant parts of local communities, as far as I'm concerned, as I just said. And I think that the fact that a new group of leaders have stepped up to continue that work and to evolve into the future is super exciting. And it's also super inspirational to me. And a lot of those community theaters and mission-driven theaters are also connected to local film scenes, film communities, film festivals. So it gives me hope, even though it's really challenging for a lot of these independent venues to survive. So if you're listening to this and you have a local mission-driven independent art house or movie theater in your community, like anything you can do to support it, whether with through donations or by being a volunteer or spreading the word or showing up to watch a movie there, it just means, I believe it means so much. And I'm excited to see and to be a part of listening to the conversations that happened this summer in Chicago when this group gets together for the first time in a bunch of years. They used to have a conference that took place right before Sundance. So to have this group coming together, it gives me hope. And I think that I look forward to just comparing notes with you as that community continues to revitalize and rebuild itself, because I think it gives me a moment of both hope and perspective on the possibility for the future.
And that was Eugene Hernandez, the director of the Sundance Film Festival, joining us here on the Box Office Podcast. A huge thank you to him for joining us this week. And another big thank you to Rebecca Pauly, my colleague, for joining me during the news segment of the podcast. The Box Office Podcast is released every Thursday, so don't forget to rate, subscribe, share it with folks. And if you're a vendor in this industry, don't forget, Box Office Pro is one of the few publications that is exclusively dedicated to covering the world of theatrical exhibition. We wouldn't be able to do so without your support in advertising. We are 100% advertiser supported, and we need your help to continue doing this every week and putting out that magazine that you love every month. Thanks again for your support, and we'll talk to you again next week.